Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to, as they say, call the meeting to order. And I would like for those of you sitting in the back, if you would just join us at the table. We have plenty of room, and everybody here is welcome guest and a participant in this in our morning's event and discussion. So please join us at the table, and if you have not already gotten a cup of coffee or juice or water, please do. We're going to make this interactive and very relaxed and informal, so we're very pleased to see you all here. I trust you were able to make it through the blizzard, the first Washington blizzard, where the federal government started sending out alerts and tweets and, you know, get ready for the big one. And, well, it didn't happen, did it? Although to some of us who happen to be from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill playing Duke last night, it was a bad night, at least for good. Kalpana, very good. Were you? Oh, that's great. I think we're just going to talk about this for a while because that. Anyway, let me welcome you all here. I'm Carl Inderfirth, known to friends and colleagues as Rick, and I'm the Woodwani Chair in U.S.-India Policy Studies here at CSIS. And we are very pleased to be sponsoring this event with the World Bank and focusing on its recently issued report, More and Better Jobs in South Asia. And I believe we'll have copies available at the end for purchase. Yep. And even maybe you can get some of the authors to sign them as a bonus. Have you had a book signing yet?
No.
No. Well, this may be a first. So I think a book signing would be entirely appropriate. So a great report, and we are very pleased to be joining with the World Bank sponsoring this event. We have a World Bank contingent. By the way, we actually are not, there's not that much of a division between CSIS and the World Bank on one end of the table and the other for any other reason than we have the presentation here. So we had to sort of split our forces here. We are actually very much joined in this effort. Kalpana Kochhar is the head of this delegation that she has brought from the World Bank. She's the bank's chief economist for the South Asia region. Welcome. She is joined by two other economists who will make presentations as well, Pablo Gadrit and Rima Nayar. We're pleased to have all of you here and also your other colleague from the World Bank. Wonderful to have you all here. I'm joined on the CSIS side by Persis Kumbhata, who is a fellow at the Wadhwani Chair and really the principal instigator, organizer for this event. She focuses on economic development at the Wadhwani Chair. Meredith Broadbent, who is the Skoll Chair in International Business, we hope will be joining us as well. So that's the CSIS team here. We also have Nick Lombardo and our team from the Woodwani Chair here. So if you have any needs, direct them to me or to Nick, and we'll make sure you get things taken care of. We're going to start by turning the program over to Kalpana, but I'd like to make two introductory remarks that come from the report itself, two important observations that were in the foreword to the report. First, the timeliness of this. It's timely because of its relevance to the region's almost half a billion young people who can make, or I would add, or break, South Asia as the region of the future. This is being referred to by many as the demographic dividend, or I think in this it was demographic dividend or curse. We have heard it expressed with respect to India as the demographic dividend or disaster, meaning in India's case, half of its 1.1, 1.2 billion population is under the age of 25. South Asia broadly is also facing that demographic dividend or curse, with 500,000 young people who will either make or break the future of the region, depending on whether or not they are educated and they have jobs and have skills to be able to contribute. South Asia will be adding some 1 million people to its labor force every month as we look to the future. So this is a major challenge, and therefore the importance of this report cannot be overstated. It's very simple. It's a very simple fact. The key to South Asia's future, including poverty reduction and also peace and stability, is the creation of enough good quality jobs in the decades to come. This is not rocket science. Either they work and contribute, or the region will not be able to even come close to fulfilling its potential. The second point in the foreword that I want to highlight is that this report is the first in a new series being done by the World Bank entitled South Asia Development Matters. It will be published annually, and with the purpose of promoting a dialogue to include policymakers, civil society organizations, academic institutions, development practitioners, and the media. All of these parties need to be brought into this discussion. And when I read that, I said, well, guess what? That's exactly what we're going to try to do this morning with this event today. So we are a part of this process which the World Bank is launching. So with that, again, thank you all for being here. May I turn things over to Kalpana to begin the presentation.
Thank you very much, Rick. We're really very, very happy to be here. I met Persis some months ago, and also other people here in the room, and mentioned this, and she was very enthusiastic about bringing us here, so I'm really pleased that it's happened. As Rick was saying, jobs, it turned out we started looking at it primarily because of what was happening in South Asia in terms of demographics. But as it turns out, it is a topical subject everywhere, including here, not so far from here, in the White House and on Capitol Hill. There are estimates that more than 30 million people have now lost their jobs since the crisis hit. And some countries, as you know, like Spain, are, you have alarming numbers like 20 and 22%. Youth unemployment is a big issue all over the world. Less so in South Asia, as you'll hear, but certainly the potential is there for it, given the number of people that are going to be entering the labor force. And, of course, as recent events in the Middle East have shown, joblessness and inequality can trigger massive political instability and unrest. So But as I said, we started looking at it because of this issue about population growth and demographics. And we said, okay, well, South Asia has actually enjoyed high economic growth of the last, it's the second fastest growing region in the world after East Asia, and most of East Asia's growth is coming because of China, and has experienced significant declines in poverty rates for the past two decades. But then it's still home to 500,000,000 poor people. It has amongst the worst nutrition indicators when compared to the rest of the world. And this is something that shocks most people when they hear about it, because a lot of people just don't even know these facts. Most of these countries are in conflict still in parts, or have recently emerged from conflict, and where conflict sort of remains a major issue, including a potential resurgence in some areas. And it faces really difficult gender and other social inclusion issues. So with all that in mind, we thought, and then finally the final consideration is, as Rick just said, is 1 million to possibly more than 1 million people entering the labor force every month for the next two decades. That's I'm not sure if any other region has faced that kind of a problem in the past, and that magnitude of a problem. So as he said, we decided to initiate this report, but as also as part of an annual so-called flagship, which really means not much, except that we, you know, except the amount of resources that go into it, I guess. And just to let you know, as a preview, the next flagship that is currently under preparation is going to be on inequality, and it's going to be a broadish definition of inequality, not just incomes and consumption as we normally think, but opportunities and access. So we'll watch for that in about 7 or 8 months. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rima. Rima will make a presentation about 25 or so, 30 minutes. But we'll go as slowly or as fast as people want to just present the main results of the report. I also wanted to introduce our two, Pradeep Mitra, who is an integral part of the team and really has been invaluable in putting this together, and Mahesh Dahal, who is basically, this report wouldn't have gotten done without him. He's the numbers guy, and he knows everything about them. So, and you already introduced Rima and Pablo. So, Rima.
Thank you. There you go.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rick, Kalpana, Nick, Persis, everybody here for coming this morning to listen to us. And I'm trying to figure out if I should sit or stand. Let me try sitting, and if I get antsy, I'll stand. And for giving me the opportunity to share with you on behalf of my co-authors the findings of this first book that the South Asia region has brought out on jobs. The book covers the 8 countries that are in the South Asia region of the World Bank. So that is India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Afghanistan, Bhutan, and the Maldives, which probably is the most in the news today anyway. There'll be people with the copies of the book. We had Kalpana might do some book signing, but there'll be people with the copies of the book, and I believe it'll be at a discount today. So let me just dive straight into this presentation. What we set out to do in this book was we asked 3 questions. First, has South Asia been creating more and better jobs? Second, what determined the quality of job creation, and what is the employment challenge ahead? Third, what demand and supply side bottlenecks need to be eased to meet the employment challenge? And we have 3 messages. First, South Asia has created many and mostly better jobs. We've created about 800,000 new jobs per month between 2000 and 2010, and what's important is that these have been better jobs in the sense that real wages have increased and poverty rates have fallen for all categories of workers. Second, most of the region faces an enormous employment challenge going ahead. As you heard a few minutes ago, we will need to absorb a much higher, 25 to 50% larger number of workers into the labor force every month. So between 1 and 1.2 million workers every month for the next 20 years. And the crux of the challenge is to absorb these workers at rising levels of productivity. And as was pointed out by Rick earlier, the demographic dividend can help meet this challenge. Third, creating more and better jobs for this much larger labor force calls for a reform agenda that cuts across sectors and includes, but is not limited to, reform in the power sector and investment, addressing early childhood nutrition, and improving the quality of education and training at all levels of the system, and reforming labor market rules and institutions and programs so that they provide protection from labor market shocks for the majority of workers rather than providing job security for just a handful of workers. So, question 1, has South Asia been creating more and better jobs? Now, what you see in this chart basically is that South Asia has created more jobs. The red bars in the middle for each country show the annual growth rate of employment in the 5 South Asian countries, in 5 of the 8 South Asian countries. And what the chart shows is that the red has broadly tracked the blue, which is the growth in the working age population. So in countries like Pakistan, you see the highest growth rate of employment. It also has the highest growth in the working age population. This is over the past 10 to 15 years, depending on the country. And in countries like Sri Lanka, which have seen the slowest growth in working age population, in fact, in Sri Lanka is the one country where the growth in working age population is now slower than that of the dependent population, you see a smaller growth in employment. But the bottom line is that South Asia has created just under 800,000 new jobs per month over the past decade. Now, so have these been better jobs? Before we get into answering that question, let's take a minute to think about the structure of the labor market in South Asian countries. Very different from the developed world, and you do not have a predominance of wage employment. Self-employment tends to be a significant share of the workforce, in some countries more than 50% or 60%. You do have wage employment, but within wage employment, you have quite a significant share of workers who are on casual or irregular wage work rather than the regular wage and salaried work that has regular pay and leave and benefits. Having said that, then, has South Asia created more better jobs? Have these 800,000 jobs been better jobs? And the answer is yes. The quality of jobs has improved for all categories of workers. And you see that the primary criteria that we use to assess job quality is rising real wages for wage workers. And in the case of the self-employed, for whom you cannot get information or reliable information on their earnings, we look at poverty rates. And what you see in the left-hand chart there is that real wages for wage workers have been growing, somewhere in most countries between 2 to 3% per year. And what in the right-hand side chart, if you look at the reds, that shows you the poverty rates for the self-employed over extended periods of time. In the case of India, we're able to look back quite a long time, and then we have a few other countries here. But in all countries where we were able to look at this, that red line has been falling. So the poverty rates of self-employed workers has unambiguously been falling, as has, if you look at the green, which is the poverty rate for the casual wage workers, and the blue, which is the poverty rate for the regular wage and salaried workers. So all categories of workers have been seeing falls in poverty rates. And for wage workers, the green and the blue falling is very consistent then with what we saw in real wages. So South Asia has created better jobs for all categories of workers. There's two things I'd like to point out here before moving on. First is, even if you see different variations in the rate of growth in wages or a rate of fall in poverty across categories of workers and over time, the broad hierarchy of job quality is maintained in the sense that the casual wage workers, the green, in all the countries have poverty rates which are 2 to 6 times higher than the poverty rates of the regular wage and salaried workers. So those jobs are much worse jobs in that sense. And they have much lower real wages as well. And you typically have the self-employed somewhere in the middle. Secondly, and we don't show this in this chart, but if you look across sectors, there's some work in the book on this, non-farm employment generally offers much better employment opportunities than work in agriculture, and particularly than casual wage work in agriculture. The casual wage workers in agriculture have the lowest real wages and the highest poverty rates, and in countries where we're able to measure, the highest degrees of vulnerability in terms of joblessness in the past year, for example. Okay, so what this chart is now showing is the share of these different categories of workers that I talked about in the rural and the urban areas in many of our countries. And what you see when you look at this chart is pretty striking, is that you, no matter what the time period, you really don't see any big change in the reds and the blues and the greens over time. The share of the workforce that has remained in self-employment or in regular wage jobs or in casual wage jobs has remained broadly stagnant or the same over the period of time, which means then that at this level of aggregation, the improvements that we're seeing in job quality are coming from improvements within these categories of jobs and much less due to movement to better job opportunities, movement from self-employment to regular wage and salary, or from casual wage to higher-end self-employment, for example. There has, now this level of aggregation does hide two things. One is you have been seeing some level of movement, some movement of workers out of agriculture into non-farm employment within the rural areas in particular over time in many of the countries. And we just discussed how those are actually the better jobs, relatively the better jobs. Secondly, this level of aggregation does hide some dynamism that you see at the individual level, where workers with higher levels of education are actually able to make that transition and that move into the better jobs. And let me show you that for a second here. What this chart shows is, this is for India. We did do it for three or four countries where we were able to. And what you can, we looked at it in rural and in urban areas. This is focusing on rural India between 2005 and 2008. And what you're looking at here on the left side is the transition, the conditional probability that if you were in agriculture in 2005, that you would have moved out to a non-farm job in the rural areas and how that varies with your level of education. What you're seeing on the right-hand side is the converse, that had you been outside of agriculture in a rural non-farm job, what is the likelihood that you would have stayed outside of agriculture or in non-farm employment or moved to agriculture, and how does that vary with your level of education? And what you see quite strikingly with the upward slope on the left-hand side for both men and women, even sharper for women, is that higher levels of education do provide the ticket to employment opportunities outside of agriculture. You see the probability that you move to rural non-farm jobs increase quite strikingly, particularly with upper secondary and tertiary education. And conversely, if you have upper secondary and tertiary education, you are much less likely to move into agriculture. You're much more likely to retain the better jobs outside of agriculture. So this takes us then, we've seen that South Asia has created more jobs and it has created better jobs and that these better jobs have come from improvements within job categories. This takes us then to the second question, what has determined this quality of job creation and what is the employment challenge looking ahead? First, the employment challenge ahead. South Asia's working age population, as we discussed earlier, will continue to grow. And even if we assume that there are no changes in the labor force participation rate, that the share of the working age population that participates in the labor force stays at what it is today, we will see the green bar in the middle, the almost 1 million workers enter the labor force every month compared to the historical just under 800,000. So for the next 20 years, even if there's no change in labor force participation rates, we'll see 1 million workers enter the labor force every month. Now, if we assume, for example, that the three countries, we all, many of us in this room have actually done work on this, and we know that South Asia has among the lowest rates of participation of women in the workforce, if we assume that the three biggest countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, which also have the lowest rates of female labor force participation in the region, see a 10 percentage point increase in the rate at which women enter the labor force, then we can see up to 1.2 million entrants into the labor force every month over the next two decades. And these rates of increase in female labor force participation have been observed in some East Asian countries, for example. So this is a perfectly reasonable range we're talking about. So the employment challenge then is to absorb this much higher level of labor market entrants, much higher number of labor market entrants, into productive employment opportunities, into jobs at rising levels of productivity. The challenge I want to stress again is much more one of quality rather than quantity, because we've seen that people can't afford, if you're in the labor force, you can't afford to be unemployed, and you will be absorbed, and the growth in the employment will track the growth in the working age population over the long run. What the real challenge then is to find better jobs for this larger number of entrants into the labor force. So how can South Asia meet this employment challenge? To answer this question, let's look back at what has caused or led to the improvements in job quality that we've seen so far. Now, as Kalpana pointed out earlier, South Asia has seen a marked acceleration in growth over the last few decades. And indeed, South Asia's rate of growth performance was second only to the East Asia region. And it is this improvement, this growth that has led to improvements in job quality across all segments of the labor force. And what this chart shows is, if you look, let's take out the, I will stand up for this anyway. If you put aside China for now, as Kalpana mentioned, look at the 1980 to 2008 period. Here you are for South Asia. You see that South Asia has the tallest bar, if you put aside China, in the 1980 to 2008 period, compared to all world regions. What's also quite striking is that in the 1960 to 1980 period, South Asia actually had the lowest bar. So this was a striking turnaround from what you saw in the 60s to the in the 1960 to 80s. The second thing I'd like to point out here is, as you know, aggregate productivity growth can be seen in its three components: the contribution from education or human capital of the workforce, the contribution from capital per worker, and the contribution of total factor productivity, which is the efficiency with which these factors or these inputs are used. And the green is showing the contribution of total factor productivity growth. And again, if you put aside China, it's really quite striking that the green is the contribution of total factor productivity growth is the largest in South Asia compared to all other world regions, compared also to East Asia during its miracle years. So what we argue then is that moving forward, this green or the total factor productivity will, of course, continue to be important. I mean, now, I should mention here that there is variation across countries, and certainly in the discussion we can get into that. But in large part, and this reflects the opening up to either internal or external competition in many of the countries, certainly that's the case in India. Now, moving forward, we argue that total factor productivity growth will continue to be important, but also what's going to be important and what might have to play a much larger role is human capital accumulation and physical capital accumulation. Now, this chart, the potential way of increasing total factor productivity growth as well. The total factor productivity growth itself can be increased by reallocating labor out of agriculture into manufacturing and services. And what this chart shows in the bottom is the rate at which some of the countries, two East Asian and two South Asian countries, have reduced the labor force, reallocated labor force from agriculture to other work. And what you see is it's a share of the labor force in agriculture. Look, for example, for a moment at India and China. At the start of China's reforms in 1978, China actually had a higher share of its workforce in agriculture than India did. And now it has a much lower share of its workforce in agriculture. Correspondingly, what the chart above shows is the contribution of reallocation of the workforce to total factor productivity growth. And you see that this purple is much larger as a contributor in these East Asian countries compared to India or Pakistan. So this may suggest then that reallocation of labor out of agriculture is the way forward. And certainly in the case of India, we do know that the share of labor in agriculture is higher than you would expect for its level of income. Now, what this chart is from the manufacturing sector in India, and it shows the jobs in the larger firms. What it shows here, if you look here, are the jobs in the larger and the formal firms pay higher wages. This, for example, shows you the share of wages, what wages are in the small firms of 1 to 4 employees as a fraction of wages in firms with 200 employees. And you see that even in the small formal firm, it's 25% the earnings that you would make, the wages that you would make in a large firm. That being said, if you look at the bottom chart, where are the majority of the workers in manufacturing? 80% of the workforce has been, over a long period of time, has remained in firms with less than 50 employees, where you have lower output per worker and lower wages. So what we argue then is that reallocation across sectors obviously needs to be accompanied by reallocation of workers from the smaller, informal, less productive jobs to the higher paying jobs and through firm expansion. And this is within manufacturing and service. I should point out that it's a very similar picture is there in services. If anything, the concentration of workers in the service, very small service firms, is even higher, with 96% of service workers in India in less than 50 size, a firm size of less than 50. So the region faces an enormous employment challenge then of creating a large, more productive jobs for a much larger workforce, a workforce that could increase by 50%. And improving job quality will require investments in human capital and physical capital for growth and also for reallocating workers to better jobs. But there is potentially good news in that many of the countries are going through a demographic transition which can provide the resources that are needed for these investments should the policy environment be conducive to channeling the savings from the demographic dividend into the needed investments. And we can come back to this. There's obviously interesting variations across countries, and we can come back to this in the discussion if need be. So this leads us then to the third question. What are the demand and supply side constraints that need to be eased to absorb this much higher number of workers at rising level of productivity? We look first at the constraints that face firms, addressing the factors which, if we address, would enable firms to expand and to create jobs. So this is the demand side. Here we use enterprise surveys, which are collected by the International Finance Corporation, the World Bank Group, to look at the most severe constraints faced by firms. And what we do, and this particular chart focuses on the urban formal sector. Now, to enable us to compare the severity of different business environment constraints as reported by entrepreneurs in different countries, within South Asia and with other countries in the world, and to take into account the fact that surveys may be different, we actually use a construct of a benchmark firm, which is basically a firm in manufacturing with about 30 employees. And we look at the constraints as reported by the benchmark firm in South Asia and in other parts of the world. And the blue bar on the left-hand side shows you the reported severity on a 4-point scale by these benchmark firms. And what you see then is the three top constraints reported by the benchmark firm in South Asia, are power, payments, and politics. So political instability, electricity, and corruption come out as the top three constraints faced by the benchmark firm. Now, we are actually interested, obviously, beyond the benchmark firm, in job creation and in firms that have created jobs. So we look additionally at the constraints that were faced by the firms that are identical to this benchmark firm in all respect, but have created jobs in the last 3 years. And the black on the left-hand side is the bar that extends that constraint for a job-creating firm. So what you see in that chart, then, is that job-creating firms report a much higher severity across all business environment constraints. But importantly, the top three constraints still remain power, payments, and politics. In other words, addressing these three Ps will make a big difference for job creation by urban formal sector firms. Now, the right-hand chart gives you some country variations, which, again, we can get into if there's time in the discussion. Now, what this chart shows, since electricity comes out as a pervasive constraint in all the countries, what this chart shows is a comparison of the severity of the electricity constraint in South Asian countries with other countries at similar levels of income, with other countries in the world. And what you see here, then, is, for example, in South Asian countries, in particularly Nepal, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan, the reported severity of the electricity constraint is much higher than you would even expect for its level of income. for their level of income. Corresponding to this, of course, what you find is that the objective indicators on power outages are very consistent, and firms in these, virtually 100% of firms in these countries report power outages. Again, consistent with this, and as you would expect, how do firms mitigate against this unreliable power supply? They invest in generators. And generator use in South Asian countries is, again, much higher than would be expected for the levels of income. And I can show you those charts. I'm trying to keep to the time limit that was given. But basically, that is a rather costly solution. And in fact, there's one estimate for India which says that 17% of India's power generation capacity comes from expensive diesel generation. So obviously there are big gaps between the demand and supply for electricity leading to these shortages, which calls for major investments, public and private, in the sector. But it also calls for reform in the governance of the sector. And we talk about it a bit more in the book, about actions to improve the financial and commercial viability of the sector, to improve the environment for private sector investment in power, and to strengthen the governance and the institutional capacity of power of the utilities. Now, we've talked about the urban formal sector, but as we all know, and as I mentioned in the beginning, the majority of the employment is actually either in the rural non-farm firms or in the large informal sectors in these countries. Fortunately, we're able to look at the constraints faced by these firms as well in some of the countries using the same enterprise surveys. And what this chart shows then is the constraints on the left-hand side for Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka as reported by rural non-farm firms, so rural manufacturing and services firms, and the right-hand side is for informal firms in India. And the blue is a comparator with a benchmark firm. The red is the particular firm we're focusing on, which is in the left, the rural non-farm, in the right, the informal sector firm in India. And the way to read this is the further away you are from the center, the red or the blue, the more severe that constraint as reported by the firms. And I'd just like to point out, we can always come back to this a little bit more, but again, what I really want to point out in this chart is that electricity remains a top constraint no matter what firm you're looking at, be it informal sector in India, be it rural non-farm firms. Also interesting, of course, is that transport comes out, and not surprising, I'm sure, as an important constraint for rural non-farm firms, and access to land comes out as an important constraint for informal sector firms. Now, we've looked so far at the demand side of the labor market. Let's look for a moment at the supply side and the skills of the workforce and the constraints faced by workers in accessing better jobs. I gave you a little bit of a preview of the important role that skills plays when I showed you that transition chart, the likelihood of people or workers making that move to a better employment opportunity in rural areas. As I said, we did that same work in urban areas in the three countries, and in that case we looked not obviously from agriculture to non-farm, but from casual wage work and low-end self-employment to higher-end self-employment and regular wage work. And we had the same striking findings that it's typically at upper secondary or tertiary levels that you start finding the ticket to move out into those better jobs. And this chart now focuses on wage workers and looks at wage premiums for the different levels of education compared to the level before. And this is for four of our countries. And what you see here with the purples and the blues is that these wage premiums have been increasing over the years. So it's either the purple or the blue in all the countries, in some cases both, have been increasing over the years, which means that the premium for higher levels of education is increasing. And look particularly at India, you've had, even between 2000 and 2010, a more than doubling of the wage premium to tertiary education. And this has happened when the labor force with tertiary education has gone up from something like 1% to 8%. So what this is suggesting then is that the demand for these higher levels of education and skills is outpacing the supply response, or the supply of increases in supply of workers with these levels of skills. Now, we've talked here, of course, about attainment, but really what we all know is important is the skills you actually come out with that are critical for labor market success and for productivity in the labor market. And we can get more into that as well in the discussion. So while the demand is increasing for higher levels of skills and education, the reality could not be more stark. Virtually all South Asian countries have made tremendous progress, and we've compared this with progress made not with other parts of the world as well in other places, tremendous progress in skilling or at least getting workers through some levels of education, particularly primary now. And if you look, other than Sri Lanka, which traditionally had very high levels of primary, all countries have dramatically reduced the share of the workforce that had no education. Nevertheless, in all of these countries, again except for Sri Lanka, more than a quarter of the labor force still has no education at all, no formal education at all. And if you start looking at the picture for women, it's much, much worse, with about half of the labor force in five of the countries, female labor force having no education at all. So, and of course, there's also a huge debate in the countries, not just that even those who have been going into primary schools and higher are not necessarily getting, are coming out with even the basic reading and writing skills and numeracy skills that are expected. So there's very much a debate and a focus in all of the countries on improving the quality of education at all levels. And you'll see a lot of, particularly I'm sure you hear it in the context of the new plan in India, which has again been called an education plan. But there's a lot of focus on education reform to improve the quality of skills of the future labor force. And that will be key. But what we argue here is that, in fact, what might be where you might get the biggest payoffs is actually in addressing the problems of nutrition and early childhood development, where South Asia has by far the worst indicators, and where, in fact, there's now an increasing body of evidence of the critical role that these years and nutrition and early childhood in particular play on in success in school, staying in school, being successful in school, learning in school, and then productivity in the labor market and the kinds of jobs you access. So what we argue then, and you can see this here, look at stunting, which is the indicator of malnutrition that is most closely related to cognitive development. Have a look at where we are in South Asia. We have worse indicators than even sub-Saharan Africa. All right, so we've talked about the demand side of the market and the supply side of the market. Let's take a minute to talk about the labor market regulations and institutions, which have an important impact on the functioning of the labor market, coming in and impacting both through the demand as well as the supply side. What the labor market institutions can play an important role in impacting job creation, productivity, earnings, and can also play an important role in protecting workers from labor market risks and shocks. And of particular interest in the South Asian labor institutions debate is the role of employment protection legislation, or rules, which are basically rules that govern the kinds of contracts that employers and employees can enter into. And what they tend to do usually is to restrict the ability of employers to enter into non-permanent contracts unless it's very, very justified. And they also restrict, they put into place costs associated with dismissing workers. So they make it procedurally very onerous or financially very expensive, or both in some cases, for employers to let go of workers. Now, obviously, these regulations can provide important protection for the workers that they cover. However, what we argue in the book is that if they're too restrictive, they can actually create disincentives for creation of jobs, of exactly those kinds of jobs in the formal sector, and they can actually, there's a fair amount of evidence from across the world that they impact the reallocation of labor between jobs and the movement of labor to the better jobs. In fact, that's where the evidence across the world is the strongest. And what you find in this, what we show in this chart, is that the enterprise surveys, again, the same surveys that I showed you earlier, the results from those, you can see the South Asian countries, the severity of the constraint is generally higher than you would expect for the level of income in South Asian countries. And look particularly at Sri Lanka, India, and Nepal, which are clearly above the level of the severity you would expect for the level of income, and are the three countries with the most severe dismissal regulations in the region, the most restrictive dismissal regulations. In all of these countries, you need permission from the state to let go of even a single worker. So in large part, what this is reflecting is some of the severity of the dismissal regulations. And in fact, what we do, what we find in our work for India is that the severity of this constraint is increasing over time. So between 2005 and 2010, this constraint is becoming more binding and more severe. There is a reasonably robust body of literature from the region, particularly India and to some extent Sri Lanka, that actually shows that these regulations combined with the dispute resolution processes, which basically don't work, do have employment disincentive effects for formal sector employment and do affect the reallocation of labor. In some work that we did with the manufacturing census that I showed you, we looked at job turnover in the large manufacturing firms and found that what employers are doing are using non-permanent or contract labor to adjust the size of their labor force, to achieve the labor adjustment, rather than going in for permanent labor where you have more restrictions. And the size of the share of the labor force that is contract labor in those firms has gone up to a quarter of the labor force from about 14% a short while ago. So what we argue here is that what's important, though, is in addition to creating potential disincentives for formal sector job creation, these rules don't really achieve the desired intention, and they don't really protect the majority of the workforce. And there's two reasons for this. First, as you can see, they cover only a very small share of the workforce. Here, if we use pension coverage as a proxy for the share of the workforce that's covered by these rules, you're looking at less than 10% of the labor force in most of the South Asian countries that these rules even apply to. And secondly, the more stringent the rules are, the more employers have found ways around these rules, and so they don't even provide as much protection as intended for the group of workers that were intended to be covered. So what we argue very strongly in the book is it's important to start thinking about moving away from relying on strong job security regulations to a set of programs that provides much stronger, much better protection for the bulk of the labor force, including the large chunk of the labor force that's in the informal sector. And countries are experimenting with various approaches to this, and we also have a number of active labor market programs in particular. And the idea is actually now to evaluate these, strengthen these, scale them up, things like public work, self-employment assistance, and so on. I'm going to spend a few minutes. This is, we have a chapter on this in the book. On conflict, as we talked about, as Rick and Kalpana said in the beginning, it's a huge issue and a huge dimension of labor markets in South Asia. An important dimension of labor markets in South Asia is armed conflict. And we all know about Afghanistan, we talk a little bit about Pakistan, but of course India also has low levels of insurgency in several states. And we've had five of our eight countries are either currently immersed in or have recently emerged from armed conflict. We looked at the labor market in conflict-affected areas, and what we find, of course, is that labor markets face similar challenges as they do in non-conflicted areas, but they're much more exaggerated. So labor markets in areas affected by conflict are much more rural, much more dependent on agriculture, more likely to have workers remain in unpaid family work and less likely for the workers to be skilled or to move into regular wage employment, the latter reflecting to a large extent the virtual absence of private employers in conflict-affected regions. Now, this chart actually looks at the severity of business environment constraints in Afghanistan and looks at how they compare. The red is provinces that are more highly affected by conflict, and the blue is the provinces that are less conflict-intensive. And what's clear is more conflict-affected provinces face a higher severity across all business environment constraints. Number one, the red is much larger than the blue. Number two, another important feature is security. Security, whether you see it captured through political instability or crime, theft and disorder becomes a very important dimension of the business environment and affects the demand for labor. And the red is much bigger than the blue. Thirdly, infrastructure and governance also are much worse in the higher conflict-affected areas than in the less conflict-affected areas. And you can see that in the transport, electricity, and so on. So in other words, the challenges are similar but far more exaggerated. And we argue in the book that there is a very important role for public policy and public programs in conflict-affected areas, and particularly for direct job creation initially through programs like DDR programs or public works programs, self-employment assistance. But at the same time, it's really important to start working on setting the stage for the private sector to become a much more significant provider of jobs in the longer run. But as I think it was Rick who mentioned, jobs need to be at the center of the post-conflict agenda, not just to help restore livelihoods, but also as an instrument for peace. So let me, to conclude, come back to our three main messages. South Asia has created many, mostly better jobs, 800,000 much higher quality jobs or better quality jobs. Most of the region faces an enormous employment challenge, but its demography can help. The reforms needed of absorbing this much higher level number of workers into more productive jobs. And finally, creating better jobs for a growing labor force calls for a multi-sectoral reform agenda, which includes, but is not limited to, the power sector, improving nutrition, improving the quality of education and training at all levels, and reforming of labor market institutions to provide real protection to workers. Thank you.
Rima, thank you very much. A great presentation and lots for us to discuss. I think, Meredith, good. Thank you for joining us. The other member of the CSIS team is now here. What I'd like to do is to just perhaps the three of us could say just a couple of words, maybe ask a couple of questions to get us started, and then turn this program over to you to ask questions of our World Bank colleagues. What I'd like to do, actually, is to call attention to the handouts that you have in the back, not the book that will be there, but the handouts that we have from the Wadhwani chair, because our focus on India, I just want to call this to your attention, has very much paralleled and tracked much of what you have heard in this discussion. You'll see in our monthly publication, which is called U.S.-India Insight, that we have done reports on elevating India's higher education, including in the very important vocational education area, where you see a sidebar piece entitled Help Wanted. We've also talked about entrepreneurship in India, the next wave, U.S.-India Innovation Partnership. All of these things very much tied to job creation, skills training, and giving the people of the country the skills that they can, that they will need to see their country progress. I also want to call your attention to another handout there, which is the one for the Wadhwani Foundation. The Wadhwani Foundation is the on-the-ground effort by Ramesh Wadhwani and his foundation to accelerate economic development in India. And as you can see, the Unleash the Human Potential of India for Global Growth is a focus, as is skills colleges. This is an important component. We're the policy component, if you will, of the Wadhwani Foundation. The on-the-ground component, which is very much doing the kinds of things that are being advocated in this report, is something that, I want to call your attention to. And interestingly, there was event yesterday in New Delhi of the Wadhwani Foundation focusing on skills development. And at that session, Kapil Sibal, who is a human resource development minister, announced a creation of a vocational education framework for India. So these are programs that are doing the kinds of things that are being advocated here. And even though I recognize this is a, something of a self-interested plug for what we're doing, I do want you to know that not only are we looking at this from a policy standpoint, but from an actual get things done on the ground standpoint. I'd like to turn to Meredith and to Persis to see if you would both perhaps raise an issue or ask a question, and then we'll go to the audience. So, Meredith, welcome. Glad that.
Thank you very much. I work here at CIS in the International Business Program, and I look at this sort of more broadly and not as a regional specialist, but I was really excited to sort of see the findings of this study and really applaud the work that's been done and the thoroughness of it. To me, it raises questions about for the United States as we spend this year kind of retooling our trade agenda for hopefully more energy after the election. We've got some choices to make both on Capitol Hill and then in the administration about sort of what our U.S. trade agenda priorities are and also what our economic development priorities are, which countries have potential that we can help in a small way. We know that over the last 50 years, sort of roughly speaking, foreign private investment is replacing foreign aid from countries like the United States as the principal source of funding for international economic development. I think, roughly speaking, the ratios of financial flows in developing countries have really flipped. It used to be 70% aid and 30% private investment. Now it's 30% aid and 70% private investment. And so from a U.S. perspective, what can we do to support this investment and help facilitate it into the sectors that you all have identified or the areas such as electricity? I mean, that seems to stand out as a big one that needs foreign investment and good rule of law and so forth. So the tools that we have from the United States standpoint in the trade area are really three. I mean, we have trade and investment framework agreements, we have bilateral investment treaties, and then ultimately, you know, potentially maybe a free trade agreement in the future, or a bilateral free trade agreement or a regional trade agreement. And I think at this point we probably have bilateral investment treaties with two of the countries, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, TIFAs maybe with four of the trade investment framework agreements, and then, of course, no FTAs yet. On the BIT side, the bilateral investment treaty side, there's a lot of interest commercially in a bilateral investment treaty with India. I think Rick has really been working on this, and we really support his efforts from the shoal chair because we think that this is a key area, and actually there's a lot of political developments on Capitol Hill with more interest going in this direction, really as a result of some work that Rick has been doing. So there was a letter recently, a bipartisan group of senators saying this is a thing the United States administration ought to look at. So we support bilateral investment treaties and then also kind of and coming up with a game plan to get to a more secure and vibrant trade relationship with some of these countries as, you know, one tool that may fit into countries' development plans, and would be interested in people's reaction on you know, whether that's a good thrust for policy and whether you all see opportunities in that type of agenda going forward next year.
Do you want to respond to that, and then Persis will?
Sure, I could try my hand at your response, but I'll take it in a slightly different direction. Obviously, I think I agree with that last bit about the investment being the platform for engagement now with India, especially given the open, you know, the fact that their capital markets are becoming more and more open. I mean, on the equity side, the market is actually very open. On other investments, somewhat less so, but becoming more and more so. In fact, Pranab Mukherjee was saying just the other day about, partly India, I guess, has had hit a bit of a rough patch on growth, and I think that's been, if I may say, a bit of a wake-up call. And I think some focusing of the minds on what needs to be done and the role that private capital in general, domestic and foreign, has to play and what... what needs to be done to make the environment more friendly towards that. But let me, if you don't mind, I think let me take a minute to talk about one other thing that's more South Asia specific but may also have implications for how the U.S. Interacts with South Asia in general, obviously with India being the biggest country, but with others as well. And I see also in the folder that there was a paper on this, so I'll piggyback on that. This is about trade cooperation and regional within the region. This is, as is mentioned in this paper that's in our, I guess, over there in the back, South Asia's trade within the region is by far the lowest in the world, hovering around 5% of GDP, while actually it's integrated in its integration through trade with the rest of the world is not that bad. It's not high relative to, say, China, but it's risen from 20% in 2007 to something like 25% in 2010, only 4 years. So it's not that South Asia is not integrating with the world, it's just what they do with each other is really very at a very low level. And we in the bank really think that trade cooperation is a huge unexploited opportunity for job creation in South Asia. And we haven't tackled it in this book, but we have other work that's going on now, and I would be very happy to have another opportunity to come here to talk to you about that. About regional cooperation and both the current state of play, but what we see as opportunities going forward. I do want to say though that given the low level of cooperation, I think there's a realization in South Asia that this has to change. It's quiet. It's not a big fanfare because of course there's on the surface everybody's still dealing with all the political issues that have been hanging over the region for so long. But quietly, I think there has been a realization that there needs to be, you cannot have a successful region, you cannot be successful part of the Asian century if you're not cooperating with each other. And for us, I think we see, what is particularly pertinent to this study here is electricity. It's the one region. There's a chart that I have when I make these presentations that shows regional power sharing agreements across the world, and sort of with little circles that show them where they the countries that they encompass. And you move across the map and you come to South Asia and it's blank. There's no regional power sharing arrangements, and that's in spite of the fact that you have a combined hydropower generating capacity in the region, unexploited, Nepal, Afghanistan, and even Bhutan, of something like 100 gigawatts, which would, more than power. And this report shows you the massive outages. You have 14 to 16-hour load shedding in countries like Nepal. You have peak shortages of 12 gigawatts in India. You have estimates of how many jobs were lost in Pakistan from power shortages, etc. And yet the region as a whole is not deficient in power and not deficient in clean power. So I wanted to bring that up as an issue I think that needs to and possibly could become a topic for discussions that you might have later on. The other reason it's really important at least from the bank standpoint is we have a map that shows poverty in the various regions, states and regions of the South Asia region. And it shows basically that the landlocked regions or the border regions are by far the worst in terms of poverty and so on. So from an inclusion standpoint, opening up and bringing these people, reducing their isolation, I think is going to be a big strategy for poverty reduction, inclusion, as well as job creation. So let me just, and of course, the other thing that stood out when I was doing some research on this is about people talk about people-to-people contact as being very important to build trust, to build trade relations, to build financial relations, etc. And I looked at the only data I could find was global inbound tourists, so which is not a great measure, but still the only measure I have of proxying for people-to-people contact. And it shocked me to find that in 2009, which is the most recent data I have, South Asia had less than 10 million inbound tourists. So all of South Asia had less than 10 million inbound tourists. It compares with 165 million in East Asia, 60 million in Latin America and the Caribbean, and 20 million in sub-Saharan Africa. So this sort of brings me to all kinds of issues like visas and restrictions and so on, which really, you know, apart from being an irritant to people who, I'm sure, who've tried to travel there, it is truly, I think, having major economic consequences. So I'll stop there with that.
Those are great comments, and all of those we could talk about for a long time, including the prospects for regional economic cooperation. Fortunately, there's a little bit of a positive report on India and Pakistan beginning to talk about most favored nation trading, and that seems to be one little glimmer of hope there. So let's hope that will expand. Persis?
Thank you. In fairness to our guests, I'll sort of offer a quick observation and a few questions. I think there's no doubt that India's economic growth has been impressive for pulling many millions out of poverty and into the workforce and the middle class. One issue I feel particularly strongly about is women in the workforce. And South Asia, in my observation, South Asia's sort of lack of urgency in making its growth story more inclusive of women in particular, but others in general as well. There's a relatively recent realization in corporate India that they need to include more women in the workforce, and there are a few more sort of plans to get them there. But it's certainly not reflected in the workforce as a whole, and sort of not when you leave the urban centers, certainly, of India and the other countries as well. So based on the data you're presented and on other surveys I've read, women make up a very small portion of the workforce. And the women who do join in India, they leave the workforce much earlier than they do in their Asian counterparts in the other countries of the region, as well as sort of compared to international norms. They tend to leave, half the women leave between the junior and mid-level of their career versus the mid and senior level of career, which is more in line with international norms. So my question for you is, can you elaborate a little bit more on why you think that's unique to South Asia, and maybe offer a few sort of solutions as what can be done from a government perspective or an industry perspective to encourage more of this untapped potential into the workforce? And what do you see as some of the enabling factors that also could be put in place to get women into the workforce and keep them there once they are there? Thank you.
I'm going to say just a few words, but I'm going to pass it on to my colleagues here who know much more and done a lot of work. So I think it's a really a multifaceted problem. So maybe I put a little bit more perspective than to add to what Persis said, right? It's to my mind, it's a combination of all of some of the things that we mentioned. I mean, it starts really with nutrition and with, you know, the World Bank constructs or puts together, you know, looks at a gender inequality index, which is five components: maternal mortality, adolescent fertility, parliamentary representation, educational attainment, and labor force participation. I know it's all endogenous, but still, just to put some perspective, dead last South Asia ranks on that gender inequality index. Something is really quite, but if you look at the subcomponents, where South Asia really lags is on maternal mortality and adolescent fertility, and this is highlighted in the most recent WDR, the World Development Report, that came out last year is on gender, and it's highlighted in there that, you know, South Asia does very poorly. Oh, you have the gender WDR on gender issues. So to my mind, it really does. It's you know, we have something like you know, child marriages, which are marriages below the age of 18. 64 million women in the world, half of whom are in South Asia, and this has all kinds of impacts. This has implications for when they're having children. There are many women in between the ages of 15 and 19 have severe anemia, and they're, you know, in pregnancy, this only becomes more severe. That leads to low birth weight. I mean, it's, to my mind, it really is a multifaceted problem that needs to be dealt with, but really starting with nutrition in a very broad sense, because it's the earliest intervention. There's, and then, as Rima points out, there's all kinds of evidence that the first 1,000 days, you know, from conception to about 2 years old, is really when a major part of your cognitive development takes place. If you're not being properly nourished, it has all kinds of consequences. I'm sure Pablo and Rima can give you statistics from studies that were done, I think, was it Nicaragua or
Guatemala?
Yeah, in Guatemala, on the impacts of this on productivity and wages and so on. So there's that aspect. Then there's specific things related to... But I do think that once you've taken care of the issues that are giving rise to gender inequality, you're going to start seeing people having more and more opportunities to participate in the labor force. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the most recent data on that's NSS-related, that's suggesting that women are getting more education, and maybe that bodes well for future... Okay.
Brief comment there, and then let's see what our...
Yeah, I mean, for a really in-depth discussion of what policy can come into place, I would actually just direct you to the WDR, because they have a very comprehensive way of looking at this. But what I would like to say is we do look in Chapter 3 of the book at what determines women's labor force participation. As you said, it is true that South Asia is perhaps the one region where you've seen complete stagnancy. Over the long run, you've seen at most a 2% increase over the last 20, 30 years in female labor force participation. So those 10% that we're talking about is a bit of a stretch, can't be done. But if we look at the determinants of female labor force participation, the things that come out are we do see huge differences by ethnicity. So there's definitely a cultural factor here. The difference, say, with a Muslim woman is 17% participation, 41% for a scheduled tribe woman. So you see, even in India, in Sri Lanka, massive differences by ethnicity. So definitely a cultural factor coming out, the age issues that you mentioned. Education has a very interesting relationship. Initially, as women get more and more educated, they pull out of the labor force. It's only when they start reaching upper secondary and tertiary do you see them actually come into the labor force. And, you know, there have been many studies that speculate on what might be going on this. One could be the fact that you made about the limited opportunities for that level of education and relative to the very high opportunity cost. Also, there's a wealth effect. As they get more educated, they might be pulling out until they reach the highest levels where the opportunity cost of staying home then becomes a major issue. We also find the number of children, and there's work on this even in the WDR, this is a huge issue, right? Childcare and home responsibilities across the world are disproportionately borne by women. Developing world, the data's out there in the WDR. But certainly that is one of the determinants for women's labor force participation. And that starts giving you some sense of some of the policy levers that you can get to with some of these. Release women's time. In fact, some of the releasing of time can come not just from making, helping out in childcare arrangements, which in fact there have been things going on, for example, around public works programs and so on. SEVA, a number of other NGOs have come in. But also things like making infrastructure, easier to collect water, release any constraints on women's time. Because all of these things then accumulate and contribute to the segregation that you already observe in the labor market. And we do a little bit of work on that in our book. We find that if you look at women's ability to move out of non-farm agriculture to non-farm jobs, in most cases, even the young women are kind of stuck. They're not moving out of agriculture into non-farm jobs as fast as men. And we have some of that in Chapter 3 of the book. In Chapter 5 of the book, we look at education and how that makes a difference to better jobs as well. And I showed you some transition charts. At lower levels of education, women are generally, with a couple of exceptions, say rural, urban Bangladesh or something, women are much less likely to be in the better jobs, whatever they are. Come upper secondary and tertiary, they are almost as likely and in some cases even more likely than men to be in the better job. So I don't think you can underestimate the role that higher levels of education will play.
Just one way to complement. I mean, all those factors are certainly the most relevant, but also as fertility rates decline, you should expect also an increased level of participation.
We started this event a little bit late, so we're going to run a little bit over time to catch up with that. If anyone does need to leave at 10:30, we will certainly understand. Let's begin. If you could give me questions and please identify yourself and affiliation. We'll start here and then Amir.
I'm Gautam Adhikari. I'm a columnist for an Indian newspaper. First of all, congratulations on bringing out this what seems to be a very, very interesting publication. I haven't read it, so I was just wondering whether rule of law or the weakening rule of law has any kind of impact on job creation, whether you have dealt with it in that, because increasing urbanization and movement from the agricultural rural sector to the metropolitan and even the smaller towns can produce, because of demographic pressure partly, a lot of impact on the capacity to deliver rule of law. And a related thing, which you have dealt with, I think I briefly saw it mentioned, is the capacity of the South Asian judiciaries to deliver contracts. So is the bank doing any work with South Asian governments? This is an area where the private sector, I don't think, can come in. So is the bank doing any work there? Because I understand the bank is doing work in other parts of the world on reforming and helping reform judicial accountability.
I mean, as Rima talked about various dimensions of the business environment, and as Mr. Adhikari pointed out, the quality of the judiciary is one of them. And there's also crime, theft, and disorder, political instability in some areas. We don't have one specific dimension of the business environment which is called the rule of law, but it straddles a number of areas. And I think that what we find is that it is a major constraint, but in the overall scheme of things, it is not among the top three, except in as much as political instability does cover some aspects of the lack of rule of law. The question on what the bank is doing, I think the area, I think there's been much more work by the bank with the judiciary and with the legal and judicial system in some of the middle-income countries. One example with which you may be familiar is the tremendous amount of work that has been done on legal and judicial system strengthening in what are known as the transition countries of Europe and Central Asia. There's a lot of work on that. There's also work in Latin America and the middle-income countries. So I think that's driven in part by what entrepreneurs are saying about the relative hierarchy of constraints. And certainly in Europe and Central Asia, where I worked for a number of years on the transition countries, this always came out as a major issue, because obviously they were trying to transition from a system where the rules of the game were very different to a market economy. One thing, let me crave the ambassador's indulgence here and say a little bit. There's one chart we have in the book, which, of course, there's no time to present, is within India, we see how the business environment varies between low-income states and high-income states. And there you do find the low-income states being very worried about infrastructure, connectivity, electricity, and so on. And the institutions, by which they mean the judiciary, the rule of law, and so on, are increasingly found to be more difficult in the higher income states. And that, incidentally, is a finding which echoes a worldwide result that in low-income countries you find a certain set of constraints to be more binding, and higher-income, richer countries you find a different set of constraints. And so the variation within Indian states, interestingly, mirrors what you find in the rest of the world.
Diane Farrell from the U.S. India Business Council, and delighted to be here, and thank you so much for hosting. On slide number 12, Rima, it was most interesting to look at the bar graph that you created, if you wouldn't mind even putting it back up. And my question really for you, for all of the economists here, is from a macro perspective, when you look at the extraordinary percentages that are service economy in India and how they effectively skipped the more traditional steps when you compare it to China, of going from a more efficient agricultural to manufacturing and then ultimately attaining the more sophisticated service level. When you look at this from a macro perspective, on the one hand, in the short term, it certainly benefited GDP growth in India. We know that there's the intent to grow the manufacturing sector, but it's been falling back in the last year from, I think, 25% to 16%, or their goal is to get it to 25% with the national manufacturing policy, more focus on Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities, et cetera. The question is, when you look at it as experts from the World Bank, do you see it as a help or a hindrance that India effectively leapfrogged several steps to get to where they are today? Some might argue almost by accident, by divine providence having to do with the private sector seeing these opportunities. But do you see it as a help or a hindrance going forward? And do you have any comments as it relates to the more traditional steps of efficiencies in the ag sector, development of manufacturing, to get back to the kinds of close to double-digit growth percentages that they were enjoying several years ago? Thank you.
I'll take a shot at it, is that I was a co-author of a paper that talked about this unique pattern of development that India went through. So first of all, I think the answer is that there has to be some larger role than there is currently now for the manufacturing sector. I don't think that India is going to be able to absorb, is it 800,000 people that are entering the labor force or so in the next, every month, of that 1.2, you know, so much of it is from India. Then the question is what parts of manufacturing? Arguably, the low-skill, low-cost manufacturing, India's probably mostly missed the boat on that one in the sense of, China having taken charge. And then also it's actually moving out of China now into the lower cost areas in East Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, et cetera, Bangladesh even. But to our minds, and I think this is where the report speaks to, there is scope in rural, non-farm manufacturing as well as services. And that, I think, is going to be the big growth opportunity. And that will happen when you have reforms in the agricultural sector that raise productivity in the agriculture, release labor from that. That it'll come from building up infrastructure and connectivity between these second and third tier cities to ports and to the bigger consumer markets. So that, I think, is the scope. But you know, beyond that, in terms of which industries and so on, I don't think we've really – this report certainly doesn't look at it. But let me stop there and see if
– Compliment. I think the outcome of concentrating on services was essentially taking advantage of a market niche and the result of an equilibrium situation. The fact is that given the huge volume of people just that South Asian Indians particularly have, and they had a good volume of highly educated and cheap people that were able to provide the services needed, that's no longer, as we saw, with the huge premiums being paid for these people, increasingly so, they're not going to be so cheap anymore. And therefore, there is a need to really move towards an increased concentration on manufacturing, which requires all the reforms that were talked about. And I think that it's very clear, I think, in the minds of policymakers that those are the needed steps.
Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, how do you define employment in your study, and how do you define poverty line in your study?
Question one. Okay. My question has to do with the presence of military and the armed forces in the economy. For example, in Pakistan, we know that, you know, beyond just being an armed force, the Pakistan Army has significant stakes in the national economy. That also might be the case in other countries such as Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. I'm wondering, in the course of doing your research, if you looked at the impact of the armed forces in the national economy and its impact on job creation.
Just two comments on the methodologies, actually. The first one, relating to the rule of law question, it seems to me that if you take in your survey as to obstacles to development, courts as sort of a proxy for rule of law, the fact that you use enterprise surveys understates that to some extent, I think, because among other things, it doesn't include the obstacles to foreign direct investment caused by rule of law, because you're tending to look for your survey towards domestic sources rather than international sources. And if I'm wrong about that, that's fine, but it was just an observation. The second one was that you note that if you can, in essence, transfer people from the informal sector to the formal sector, their wages rise, or at least after the fact, the wages are much higher in the formal sector than the informal sector. But it seems to me, and this is very relevant to the current controversy over single source retail and multi-source retail now, that's looking at it after the fact. But in fact, it doesn't necessarily take into account the job losses in the informal sector or the gains in inequality as a result of the transition from the informal sector, which is what you have now in retail or largely in retail in India. Moving it into the formal sector, there would be a significant deadweight loss to the informal sector while you're gaining in the formal sector at the same time.
Good questions on definitions and what we use. After a while, you take it for granted, and it's nice to go back and think about, yes, what definition did we use? We basically use a definition of employment that's as close as possible to the ILO definition of were you employed in the past week. But we were limited in many cases by the surveys, and so in a couple of countries we had to look at past month. But we do use a standard international definitions of labor force participation and employment adapted to the realities of the South Asian surveys. And we have an annex on that, even in the overview, on the definition of the key terms that we use. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a standard employment. On poverty, we use the poverty rates that are based on domestic national poverty lines. We don't get into trying to deal with the issues of comparing between countries. This is really a concept that's very relevant within each country. There was not, the public services and armed forces. I have to say sorry, we actually didn't, and I suspect that would be a very, very interesting issue to look at. And certainly we did. Not all of the countries even allowed us to look at the composition of the public administration and public services and the various classifications. Some did come out quite large on public administration as a whole. I mean, we have huge public employment, for example, in Sri Lanka. But we weren't able to disaggregate and look at that, and that wasn't a question we actually did look at, although I must say it's an intriguing question. So,
can I just add to that quickly? There's an Afghanistan transition report that I don't know if you've seen yet, but I believe it has been made public. This is a report that was done for the bond
conference in December last year for what is going to be, and the essential question was what's the impact of transition and how should they deal with it on growth, on employment, on fiscal revenues, on et cetera, et cetera. So very wonky kind of economics report. But there they got to some part of that question, and but unfortunately I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. But I'm happy to pass that on to you at the future.
It just seems to me a critical question, only insofar as in many of these countries the military is seen as the only viable employment option. And so it would seem to me that if we're trying to look at job growth, this is a critical area to kind of study in more in depth. So.
The enterprise surveys that we use have all kinds of firms. And one dimension on which you can cut it is, are they majority foreign-owned or are they majority domestic-owned? Another dimension in which you can cut it is, are they exporting firms primarily or are they for domestic markets? So the perceptions that were put up refer to all of those, and we can slice it in different ways depending on what the story is. But in the presentation, we didn't do that. But just to assure you that it was both domestically majority-owned entrepreneurs as well as foreign majority-owned. And in some cases, it's quite interesting to see what the differences are.
The rule of law, and there's two things to be cautious about surveys to enterprise surveys. One, it's obviously asking existing firms, right? So we don't have the luxury of asking firms that did not become a firm because of some of the constraints. So that's, and rule of law may be a very important issue why some firms do not come into being. And we don't know. These are asking existing firms. Secondly, obviously, there is some degree of what do you mean by rule of law as opposed to your answer to corruption? And you know, those, you know, it's a subjective answer. So to some extent, you know, that is also a nuisance that you have to take into consideration.
Great. Thank you all. I'll call attention to Kalpana's preface for the book. She said that although details vary by country, overall there is reason for cautious optimism about more and better jobs for South Asia. But she also said there is no room for complacency. I might paraphrase President Clinton, who, as you know, famously said about the economy, it's the economy stupid. I think in terms of development in South Asia, it's about the job stupid. Not to offend anyone. So we will focus on jobs. We'll focus on other such reports. Let's give a round of applause to our World Bank colleagues. Thank you very much for this.